Good afternoon. If everyone can take a seat, please. Good afternoon. If everyone can take a seat, please. Okay, thank you very much. As you can see, there's fewer of us up here than there was the last time as a result of some retirements that we've had. But my name is Bill Moran. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of the Department's Enforcement Section. To my immediate left is Wayne Bell, our Chief Counsel. I'll try to speak directly into the mic. To my far right is Dan Sandry, and he's our Chief Auditor. And to my immediate right is Steve Ellis, who's our chief over at administration, which includes HR, our fiscal section, our IT section, and our licensing section. So Steve wears many hats at the department. Okay, today we're going to have a program for you. I will start off with the operations report that typically had been the role of Barbara Bigby, who is now retired. Immediately following that, Wayne Bell will discuss some of the current issues that we're seeing in the real estate market. Steve Ellis will then follow with our implementation of some of the legislation that we had last year, particularly as it affects licensing. And last year was a very active year for us legislatively, so it's created a lot of work in terms of formulating regulations and policies and procedures to implement all of it. And then lastly, Dan Sandry will come up and present a few audit cases to you and let you know what some of our current auditees are up to. And then finally, we'll finish with a question and answer session. So to begin with the operations report, I will be summarizing our fiscal and our workload information for the current fiscal year from July 1st through March 31st. This first slide provides monthly fiscal information as to the revenue, net expenditures, and reserve balances for each month of this fiscal year. The first 9 months of this fiscal year reflect that we are seeing a 9% overall decrease over the prior year in terms of revenue. At the same time, expenditures are up about 8%, and there are three basic reasons for this. First, we opened two new electronic examination centers in San Diego and La Palma. Secondly, we placed a substantial amount of money in an architectural revolving fund to cover the cost of moving our Sacramento office to a new location. Our lease at our current office has expired, and actually several months ago, so we're currently paying on a month-to-month basis. The property owner is in the process of refurbishing the entire building and would really like for us to leave so that he can complete that. And so we have been working more or less in a construction zone for the last several months, and it's, you know, it is time for us to move to a new location. So we have approval. We have a budget change proposal that has been approved. We have approval from the legislature to make the move, but we did have to encumber the money this fiscal year. Otherwise, our approval would expire as of June 30th. So part of the reason for the increase in expenditures is that. And then lastly, we moved a lot of our service contracts as far as the renewal of those up this fiscal year so that we wouldn't have them expire during the July to September time frame. Unfortunately, as you all know, many times there's a budget impasse that takes place after the close of the fiscal year, and without a budget, we can't spend any money. A few years back, we actually were in a position where we almost ran out of postage waiting for a budget to be passed. So we actually changed a lot of our service contracts from on a fiscal year basis to a calendar year basis, and because we moved those up and actually double paid this year, that did increase expenditures this year. The net result of all this is that our reserve balance, there was a drop from about $33 million last year to about $30.5 million this year. Okay, so this is a visual comparison of the 2 years, and again, you can see these reflect 9% overall decrease in revenue, slight increase in expenditures, and as a result, a little increase or decrease in our reserve balances. Now, because of the cyclical nature of real estate, and our revenues actually have a direct correlation to the real estate market, and that's because our revenue sources are primarily come from examination fees, license fees, and subdivision fees. And fortunately, this year, we have a new license type that we issue, an MLO endorsement, and the revenues that we've received through that process has really helped to at least limit some of the reductions that we see in revenue. Moving on to our licensing workload, it's pretty much all down. Our salesperson examinations have dropped by about 15% over last year. Our broker examinations are down about 13%. Now, to provide some perspective on that, as you can see from the slide, this year we've conducted roughly 35,000 or so examinations. If you go back to October of 2005, we actually gave 18,417 examinations in a single month. So as you can see, the business as far as new examinees has slowed down considerably. Moving on to the issuance of actual licenses, salesperson licenses issued are down about 13%, while broker licenses issued are down about 8% over the same period in the prior year. With respect to license renewals, the key factor that we always look at in terms of license renewals are the percentage of licensees who are up for renewal who actually go through the process and renew. Our salesperson renewal rate so far this year is about 60%. That's down 1% from last year. And our broker renewals are about 75%, which is down 5% from the previous year. So what has all this done to our licensee population? We are now at about 424,915 licensees. This is as of March 31st. If you go back to our high, which was in fiscal year 2006-2007, we're at over 537,000 licensees. So what that means is we're losing an average of about 1,900 licensees each month. MLO endorsements. This is a new license type. I'm sure a lot of you are aware of the fact that in order to negotiate a residential 1-to-4-unit loan for compensation, there's now an MLO endorsement required to a real estate license if you're using the real estate license to do that work. We began issuing the endorsements in January of 2011, and our first renewal period was in January 1st, 2012. We have a little over 24,000 MLO endorsees, and really the revenues generated here are not only helping to reduce our revenue loss, but it's also helping to offset the cost of regulating the mortgage loan business, which has always been a fairly labor-intensive area. Moving on to enforcement activities. Our enforcement program is comprised of investigators, auditors, and attorneys. And in essence, so far this fiscal year, we're exceeding our pace of even last year, which was a record-setting year in terms of the number of disciplinary actions that we have taken. License denials, which are usually the result of an applicant having some kind of a criminal history, we're at 207 this year. Last year, we had denied about 184 licenses as of this point. Disciplinary actions are currently at about 840. And that represents an increase of 159 over last fiscal year. Desistant refrain orders, we've issued 158 desistant refrain orders. This is principally, not exclusively, but principally for unlicensed activity that's taking place in some area. A lot of it is still loan modification. And that represents a slight increase of about 10 over last fiscal year. Our investigative audits. This fiscal year, we've done 476 investigative audits compared to 389 at the same point last year, representing a 22% increase. So that is considerable, considering our auditors really work on a program that is pretty much, standardized in terms of the amount of time that it takes to get through an audit. So Dan should be congratulated on that. bar orders. We've issued 16 bar orders so far this year. And this is a relatively new authority that the department has to bar the worst of the worst that we see from any position of employment at a company that is involved in real estate-related activity, which includes any real estate brokerage, any escrow corporation, any title company, and any lending institution in the state of California. So last year we had issued about the same at this point, and we had issued 15. This is more of a graphic example of our enforcement activity, and it provides more of a historical perspective. And as I said, last year was really a record-setting year in terms of the number of licenses that we disciplined. If you go back to, some of the boom years, you go back to fiscal year 5, 6, 7, you can see our license denials during that time were very high. And when you consider we were doing, at least one month, 18,000 examinations, you could understand why. We had a lot of background investigations to do to keep people with criminal histories out of the business. That activity has obviously dropped off, but our license disciplinary actions have increased. So in recent years, the department has averaged over 1,100 administrative actions a year, and that's resulted last year in over 800 license revocations and surrenders, and we had issued over 200 desist and refrain orders. And again, so far this year, we're on pace to exceed last year's numbers. Subdivision activity. So far this fiscal year, we have issued 1,049 public reports. That is about the same as last year. As you can see, the blue cylinders on your screen represent the new subdivision public reports that we've issued, and it is about even. Perhaps some of the good news is that over the last few months, we have seen an increase in subdivision development, primarily in Orange County. And because this is a job-intensive area for employment in California, it'll be good when that whole industry does bounce back. But to show you more of a historical perspective, if you go back 6 years, you can see we are currently at about one-third the amount of public reports that we issued back in fiscal year 2005-2006. And beyond that, most of the public reports that we're issuing now are for smaller phases. So developers aren't opening very large projects. They're basically opening or phasing their projects with fewer units being constructed as they move through so that they don't have a lot of unsold inventory sitting there. So it doesn't so much reflect the number of new housing units that are being developed in California. So that concludes my presentation on the operations report. And at this point, I'll turn the podium over to our Chief Counsel, Wayne Bell, who will discuss some of the current issues that we're seeing in the real estate marketplace. And that will include some of the issues that we're seeing in the area of new subdivisions. So thank you very much, Wayne.
Killed my one slide. There it goes. Well, thank you, Bill, and good afternoon. I'm very pleased that you joined us at the DRE Forum, and it's great to welcome you. And Bill, I'm not certain if you introduced the folks from DRE. We are based here in Sacramento, as you know, and some of our staff has come here with us today, and I'd just like them to stand up and just be acknowledged. Yeah. I want to start by telling you that I'm always happy and pleased to talk with members of the California Association of Realtors, and I believe that my colleagues share that sentiment. In addition to being licensees of the Department of Real Estate, you are experienced and dedicated practitioners who are committed to upholding high standards, to advancing professionalism and integrity in serving the public in real estate matters, and advocates just like we are at the DRE, of ridding the real estate industry of those who take advantage of consumers by the use of fraudulent and illegal conduct. In this area and many others, such as public education and awareness and support for enforcement actions against those who are unlicensed but who engage in licensed acts and those who are licensed but fail to follow the law, we and the NCAR have shared interests. In addition to all of the above, and this is with due respect to all my lawyer colleagues, you are a lot more fun to be with than lawyers. I'm sort of a glutton for punishment because I agreed to speak to the Legal Affairs Forum earlier today, and so I broke from there, and now I'm here. The title, as you can see from the title of the agenda today, the topic of my discussion is current issues in the real estate market. But you are the experts in what's going on in the real estate market. You have knowledge of what's happening in the real world of housing, foreclosure inventories, capital in the marketplace, and the like, and I wouldn't even venture near those topics. But what I can do and what I plan to do is to talk with you about a couple of issues, problems, and cases that we are seeing at the Department of Real Estate, and I'm hoping to do that without boring you. Also, as I stand here, I now know what my professors thought when they saw no one sitting in front of them. There's a huge, huge gap here. In the spirit of the full discussion that we're going to have today, I want to start by talking about some interesting, serious, and thorny issues we're seeing in our subdivisions area, and then discuss the uptick in timeshare resale fraud, provide you with some information about an alarming spike in conversion of trust funds, and then briefly share some interesting matters from the DRE's enforcement portfolio. Okay, subdivisions. Recently, as a result, and I should say a continuing result, of the softening of the new home market, we've had a number of developers, whether they're small or large, file for bankruptcy protection. And that raises a bunch of issues. We've had our subdivisions people come over to us to ask us all sorts of questions, and we're trying to grapple with those now. We're investigating them, we're researching them, and we're trying to figure out the best thing to do as far as policy perspective. Now, I am not an expert in subdivisions at all, but we do have experts in the subdivisions area in the Department of Real Estate. We have a relatively small subdivided lands unit, and they're in Los Angeles and in Sacramento, and they do subdivided lands, and that's standard subdivisions and common interest development subdivisions, and they also have oversight of timeshare issues. But what we're seeing now is developers filing for bankruptcy, and then they're no longer in the picture. So when a developer files for bankruptcy, what happens is the court sometimes appoints a receiver to take over the project, and other times it will find a successor builder, a successor developer to take in and oversee the project. But what we are seeing is a number of issues, including the following. We're seeing partially completed homes. We're seeing a significant number of unsold homes in a larger development. The existence of lots of mechanics liens, which ultimately must be cleared. Incomplete common area facilities and common interest subdivisions due to failed arrangements for their completion or insufficient financial reserves. Failures to convey common areas. So someone will buy into a development and then they don't have access to their particular unit or home, failures to initiate the operation of homeowners associations. And with regard to this point, I want to read to you a note from Wes Jagor, one of our senior managers in subdivisions, where he kind of highlights this issue in particular. He wrote, "The subdivided lands law and the regs contemplate that the subdivider will control the setup and initial operation of the homeowners association until the purchasers acquire enough interest to take over control of the voting power and association operation. An early bankruptcy of the subdivider puts the project and the early purchasers in peril until everything is sorted out through the bankruptcy court and or when a successor comes in. And if a successor does come in," he writes, "they often desire to change the project for marketing purposes, and such a change or changes may result in a much different project than originally planned and marketed." So we have all the previous issues, and then we also have failures to pay assessments. And that, in turn, constrains the operation of the homeowners associations, including the funding of reserves. We have improper releases of purchase money deposits and failures to amend the public report previously issued by the DRE to reflect the post-bankruptcy circumstances. And then other thorny issues, and these ones the lawyers are researching, and I know some of the lawyers who represent many of you are looking at the same issues, is it proper to sell the new units as is because the original developer is not there? And then what about construction defect liability? Who has liability for construction defects if the developer is bankrupt? In the case of a receiver, I think the receiver is going to say, I have the coverage of the bankruptcy court, and therefore I shouldn't have any liability as a participant in the court process. And then the successor developer, they're going to argue whatever they argue. So these are just some of the issues that we've seen. And, you know, there are subsidiary issues, and there are smaller ones, there are more complex ones, less complex ones. But the reason that I wanted to raise this today, and Bill and I talked about this, is because you oftentimes are called upon to sell units in a condominium complex, in a standard subdivision, where the original builder is out of the picture whatsoever. And so the question becomes, and I don't have the answers, but I know the questions that are going to come up. They're going to ask why you didn't know that the common facility wasn't going to be transferred. Did you look at whether there are appropriate reserves? When they bought into the project, or they're thinking about buying into the project, and it says Olympic-sized pool, and it turns out it's a little kiddie pool, I think they're going to be a little upset about that. So we're just pointing this out because the issues come up a lot for us right now. And from a disclosure standpoint, obviously, you'll want to disclose the fact that the original builder has filed for bankruptcy protection, that there was a public report issued by the Department of Real Estate. It has been amended or may need to be amended, and the things have changed as far as what that project looks like. Many times there were plans for multiple phases. There won't be multiple phases now. There might be a gym involved, a pool, or whatever the amenities might be, and those things just won't be in place. And so it's just something to think about as far as disclosure to the folks who are buying in or who have bought in. And the key is you always want to have an amended public report where all of the material changes and all the material issues with regard to that project are disclosed. And if you have any questions about this afterwards, I'd be glad to talk with you about them. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we have people in our subdivisions units who are really expert in this area, and they're taking this very seriously, and they're looking at this. They're talking with very, very capable counsel who focus on the development of subdivisions throughout California. Now, turning to the issue of timeshares, how many of you in this room, by show of hands, have a timeshare or own a timeshare? Okay. Now, if any of you want to sell those timeshares, Bill and I have many interested buyers, and all we need from you is a small upfront fee of $1,000 to cover some paperwork and processing fee. Well, sadly, that is the pitch that people throughout California are hearing now, and we're seeing more and more of this. In fact, I just recently co-authored a alert with one of our senior investigators down in Los Angeles, a guy named Nicholas Kane, because he's been researching timeshare resale fraud. And what we're seeing in this area, as we've seen in so many other areas where we experience fraud, is folks who are desperate to unload a property that they have, and they're susceptible to folks who say, we have a buyer, or we can help you, and all you need to do is pay monies in advance. And they take those monies and do little or nothing. And as you know, if you accept monies in advance, before services are performed, you need to have an advance fee agreement that's been submitted to the department, reviewed by us. We issue a no objection letter, and then those monies have to go into a trust account, and unearned fees are returned to the folks. But what we're seeing in the timeshare area is pretty outrageous and pretty rampant. And if you're interested in seeing the latest timeshare alert, it's on our website, and it covers the different types of fraud that we're seeing. Now, most of the scams involve a promise of a quick sale of the seller's timeshare interest in exchange for an upfront fee. There are, as you might imagine, a number of variations, but the following are three of the common fraudulent practices that we've seen as of late. And the first one actually is shocking to me, and it's something that you need to be aware of. Unlicensed and illegitimate timeshare reseller fraudsters are posing as and using the identities of legitimate and licensed real estate brokers. So they're either getting on our website, or they're finding out who you are, your names, your numbers, and they're saying, I am, and they give out your legitimate name, your real numbers, and they say, I can sell this for you. Then they take the money, and then they run, and you're either on the hook or someone's going to be looking at you saying it was your name, you were involved in the sale. So what we've put in this alert, and it's just a starting point, we say, get the name of the person who calls you or makes the solicitation. Get the name of the purported broker or salesperson they purport to be. Look them up on the DRE website. Locate a phone number for the licensee. Call that licensee at that number, and then verify that the person who made the contact actually works in the number called. Now, this hasn't happened in a number of cases, but it's happened in enough cases where it's somewhat disconcerting. And it's the unlicensed folks who are figuring out that they have a much better hook, and they add legitimacy where they say, sure, I'm a real estate broker, I'm a salesperson. Look me up on the website. You'll see I have no discipline, and I've got a sterling record. But what they're doing is they're harming the sterling record of someone else who is licensed by us. The second thing that we're seeing are scammers targeting timeshare owners and falsely telling those owners that the agent has found a ready and willing buyer, just like I did at the outset of this. The scammer asks for a listing, processing, or paperwork fee to effect the transaction, but once the fee is collected, the seller never hears from the scammer again. And then last but not least, what we're seeing over and over again are these crooks posing as timeshare buyers, and they use such advertising slogans as, we'll buy your timeshare for cash, timeshares wanted, or something similar, to lure timeshare owners and then ask for owners for a small amount of money up front to process paperwork. And once those monies are paid, the owners never hear from the scammers again. In fact, Bill and I saw a case not that long ago where someone was duped into believing that they found a ready, willing, and able buyer, and I think it was for $16,000 and for some unwanted timeshare. And the person was so excited, they wrote a check for well over $1,000, and of course they got nothing in return. Now, trust fund conversion. In a moment, Dan Sandry, who's the chief of our audit section, is going to tell you about some fascinating facts in connection with some fraud. But Dan heads up a very small unit of our department, but they're very dedicated, they're very smart, and they know what they're doing. That's our audit section. There are only about 31 auditors statewide, but they're really tremendous, and they're very talented. In connection with my presentation today, I asked Dan if he could provide me with some numbers about trust fund shortages that we're sadly seeing with much more regularity. And we at the department, just so you know, we have regular executive committee meetings where we talk about the issues that we're seeing. And what we're trying to do is focus in on the matters that are important to you, that are important to us, and that really will help protect the public. And in connection with that, we also have these, they're called duty days, they're phone duty days. And our lawyers take calls on particular days, and Bill's staff in the enforcement unit will take calls. And what we try to do is mine those calls to see what is happening out in the marketplace, what the public is complaining about, what realtors are focused on, and things such as that. But in one of our recent executive committee meetings, it was shared that we're seeing a lot of trust fund conversions, and that's alarming to us, and I know it's alarming to you. So here are some of the statistics that I got from Dan and his group. For the period from January 1, 2011 through March 31, 2012, in property management audits, and that's just focused on property management where people take in money from rents and the like, our auditors found that in 37% of those audits, there were trust fund shortages totaling $7,301,429. Those shortages were due to, among other things, and this is the one that's the first two are the most troubling. Commingling, that's where the monies are put into general operating accounts, and then actual conversion where they take the money and then leave town, of $777,508. Embezzlement, and that's where someone inside a brokerage has embezzled the money from the brokerage itself, of $689,711. Next, in the area of broker-controlled escrows, and we're seeing more and more broker-controlled escrow issues. In those audits, our auditors found that in 31%, there were trust fund shortages totaling $4,064,108. And commingling and conversion in the area of broker-controlled escrows accounted for $3,898,559. And then finally, in the area of mortgage loan audits, it was discovered that in 15% of those audits, there were trust fund shortages totaling $1,723,729. And the majority of those shortages were due to commingling and conversion of $895,000, almost $896,000, and then negative balances in the area of hard money related loans. Earlier, I promised to tell you about some interesting matters, and I plan to do that now. The first one follows perfectly, I think, from the discussion of trust fund shortages. To give you a feel for the case, which is currently being investigated, I suggest that you think of a gambler in a last chance casino who wants desperately to put funds belonging to others into the winning bets he thinks will put everything right with his business. Because the matter is ongoing, I can only give you a broad brush, and I'm not going to share any names with you. But in this matter, we have a corporate real estate broker controlled by a designated officer. The corporation properly set up a property management account for the various properties it manages. It also had a security trust account for all the deposits, just as it should, and a general operating account. All of this sounds right, yes? But what our auditors have discovered is that the designated officer transferred significant amounts of money of over six figures from the property management account and security deposits into the general operating account, and then used those monies for gambling, and not very successfully, I must say. And you can imagine that that fact scenario does not sit well with us or with the property owners, and that case is proceeding. And the second matter is just a piece of a much larger problem. A senior citizen walked into our Los Angeles office in February of this year, and she informed our staff that when she tried to refinance her property in Pasadena, she discovered that four forged deeds had been recorded against her property in 2002. It appears that a real estate salesperson who was revoked for activities unrelated to our complainant's allegations had referred the complainant to a somewhat notorious scammer who offered to save our complainant's home from foreclosure and order filed for bankruptcy protection. The story relayed by the complainant became the basis for another DRE consumer alert that I've co-authored with another one of our senior investigators in Los Angeles, Summer Bakatich, and it talks about the rising tide that we're seeing of forged and fraudulent deeds. In doing our research for the alert, we discovered that the victims of fraud involving forged and or fraudulent deeds are oftentimes senior citizens who have substantial equity in their property or who own their homes free and clear of any mortgage loans. In such cases, the fraudsters can create a fake promissory note showing that the senior citizen owes the scammer money and then forge and record a deed of trust securing the promissory note. The senior may never know about the recorded deed during his or her lifetime. For many people, the idea of a forged or fraudulent deed sounds either unusual or academic, but I can assure you that the forged and fraudulent deeds are not the stuff of theory. They are on the rise as fraudsters take advantage of the huge number of foreclosures, short sales, vacant properties, and unsuspecting seniors. In fact, yesterday I was provided with a story, and I will not share the person's name because while I'm sure he's guilty, he has the presumption of evidence, but here's the story. Man arrested for forging grant deeds, renting out foreclosures. John Doe, let's call him John Doe, has been arrested and charged with real estate fraud, identity theft, forgery, and preparing fraudulent credit applications. The investigation began after investigators received a fraud complaint from a notary public who alleged that her signature and seal had been forged on a grant deed. The suspect allegedly filed fraudulent grant deeds on properties that were in the process of being foreclosed, causing the process to be delayed. The suspect would then rent the property to unsuspecting renters. The suspect would also fraudulently obtain home equity lines of credit on the properties, as well as use false information on credit applications to purchase luxury automobiles. So, as I mentioned before, when we see these sorts of issues, we try to alert the public, and we want to share this with you as well. Now, Bill, you're looking at your time. Am I going over time? I'm good? I'm good. Okay. Then I want to talk with you about what some recorder's officers are trying to figure out how to stem the amount of forged deeds. And as you probably know, if a document that appears to be recordable is is in a recordable form. It has the proper notarial information on it. A recorder's office will record that no matter what. And so what we're seeing is an effort of recorders to try to figure out what to do in this realm. And one thing that some counties are doing is they're actually taking thumbprints to make certain at least that they'll be able, oh, they're having the notaries take the thumbprints, so at least that when someone signs a forged deed, they can go back and find out who that person is. Now, in addition to the forged deeds, criminals promising to save homes from foreclosures trick homeowners into signing deeds to the home. They force people to sign deeds. And it's just something that is pretty awful. And I want to show you a recent case where this exact type of fraud took place. And it was, and I don't know if you've seen this or not, but we've seen it in the department. In that case, an Orange County man, who it appears was licensed by the DRE many years ago, he swindled other elderly people out of their homes after promising to help them avoid foreclosure. The title in the Los Angeles Times article was "Housing Scam Brings Up to Life Sentence Under Three Strikes Law." And what was most interesting about this case is, as you know, under the three strikes law, if you have three serious felonies, you can go away in a state prison for 25 years to life. He never used a weapon in any of his crimes. All of his crimes were real estate fraud related, but the court here thought that his activities were so bad that he should be sentenced to 25 years to life. Here is the article. The 49-year-old, and I will give you his name here because it was reported in the press, Timothy Barnett, was convicted last month of 17 felonies for tricking five people into knowingly granting him title to their homes. He had been convicted of similar charges in the 1990s. The worst thing you can do is take someone's home, Los Angeles County Superior Court Judge Stephen Marcus said, explaining the lengthy sentence, which, as I said, was 25 years to life. Instead of helping people, he stripped the equity from their homes and left five people homeless. Barnett's latest crimes occurred between 2005 and 2007. The victims were older residents of poor South Los Angeles communities who had used the explosion of real estate values to borrow against their equity, only to fall behind in the payments. That's when Barnett appeared. Victims testified that he went to their homes and prayed with them, saying he could help them keep their homes, bring loans current, reduce monthly payments. What Barnett didn't make clear is that he would end up owning the homes. Along with their homes, the victims cumulatively lost nearly $900,000 of equity to Barnett. And this is what the judge said. Here's a career criminal who specializes in real estate fraud. He preys on the weakest people in our society. Among the most recent victim was an 85-year-old blind widow named Dorothy King. Mr. Barnett's lawyer has stated she intends to file an appeal on his behalf. I will conclude my presentation with a discussion of that case, which is really quite unusual as far as a sentence, and tell you that the department is continuing in its efforts to combat fraud and to go beyond our statutory duties in reaching out to others who can help us combat that fraud. As you know, we have relatively limited remedies. We have a small department of 360 employees statewide with five offices. In the legal section, we have 22 lawyers, only 17 of whom are administrative prosecutorial lawyers. And so we're reaching out to other public service partners, which includes the Attorney General's office, the FBI, U.S. Attorney's office, and fortunately, Carr as well. And I want to applaud Carr for its anti-fraud efforts. I know you're going to have a statewide anti-fraud effort, and next week, in fact, there's going to be a press conference up here in Sacramento where you're going to be introducing a press release as well as an alert on loan modification fraud. But the thing that I want to say to you is that I appreciate, we all appreciate your efforts, your help, your partnership, and your sharing with us the effort to try to rid the real estate industry of the bad players that none of us want to see out there. And with that, I thank you for your time. Hope you have a great afternoon. And I'd like to introduce Steve Ellis.
I know about you, but I'm impressed. Good Lord.
all that bad stuff, and not only to mention the fact that he got me shut down here, and what do we do with our techie guy? That's supposed to be me, but oh, there we go. I'm trying to. We're having technical problems. Are you going to be applying for that new IT job that's going to head open? Wow. Well, I'm here to talk about legislative implementation, and I know that's just some of the most exciting stuff you can have. When I was starting to take a look at what kind of presentation I should make, I started looking at my program areas and everything going on within and with other program areas to make this legislation work, and I thought I would lose every one of you in the process. Very active legislative year last year. There's a number of provisions that we're now forced to implement. I got a great licensing team that's in the back there. They're kind of in the center of the flow of everything that's going on. I have a fantastic IT section that unfortunately has about a dozen other projects going on, and we're trying to get regulations developed that coincide with the new legislation. It's just the fiscal section is having to develop different ways to record and collect money. So just the whole section, my sections and some of the other programs are just working diligently to try to get the legislation implemented. So the four major pieces of legislation we're going to talk about is SB 53, 706, 510, and 1424. Now we have called SB 53 cite and fine is actually a half a dozen different provisions there, and we call SB 706 cost recovery, and there are also various other provisions that go beyond cost recovery. But so I'm going to start out with the cite and fine. The effective date of the cite and fine legislation is generally January 1. It's already in effect. There are some provisions that begin July 1st. And if, I'll note them if the beginning dates are any different. But anyway, it impacts a number of provisions of the Business and Professions Code and some of the other code sections that are shown there. Generally gives DRE more enforcement tools to combat mortgage fraud and other real estate misconduct, which is what its intention was. And the first provision, the cite and fine provision, authorizes DRE to issue citations up to $2,500 to both licensed and unlicensed persons for minor violations of the real estate law.
These citations are public records pursuant to the Public Records Act that are not given formal disciplinary action numbers and are not placed in the public comment section of GRE's website. So what all that means is that if one of our auditors goes out or an investigator goes out to a broker, finds some minor violations, in the past we had only one option, and that was to take formal disciplinary action against the broker, and if that resulted in a finding of a violation, that violation carried with the licensee record for ever. I mean, somebody looks you up, it's on there. Under cite and fine, it won't show up on the public record. It will be available pursuant to a Public Records Act a request, I should say. But it won't be won't show up on your record. As I had mentioned, the department's legal section is developing regulations to establish violation types and other criteria standards for cite and fine cases. We recognize that not all types of violations are cite and fine violations, and we also want to make sure that whatever we use as our standards, you know, that we're fair. And so we also have created a cite and fine desk to where we can set a fine amount at a level that is consistent statewide, and that desk will be mailing out citations receive and record and forward payments to our internal fiscal section, monitor requests for hearings, send delinquency amounts to fiscal to set up accounts receivable, and refer the case to legal as appropriate for action if a fine isn't paid. Citations can also be used to notify licensees of the need for a simple corrective action and do not necessarily require a fine. So it's a tool that will enable us to issue a citation rather than go through the entire disciplinary process, and also to notify you that, hey, you need to correct that, whether there's money involved or not. All right, some of the other provisions, as I mentioned, there's five or six provisions to SB 53. One of them is subpoenas. SB 53 authorizes DRE's commissioner to apply to Superior Court, and this, I guess, is going to start out being Wayne, to enforce DRE's administrative subpoenas. Historically, DRE has used the Attorney General's office to enforce its subpoenas, which was costly and considered low priority with the AG. It's just one of those things where if somebody ignores a subpoena, we have administrative subpoena powers, but if we get ignored, we can't really enforce those without getting the AG involved to go to court on our behalf. Now that's going to enable the Department of Real Estate to actually go directly. It should be good. Next provision, disclosure of investigations. This provision says that DRE can now disclose active investigations to the public if other disciplinary action has been filed against a licensee. Typically, say there's a bad guy out there operating, and we know there's a danger to the public, and yet somebody calls in and says, do you have anything going against an individual? The record will look clean unless we file something, and we cannot disclose, due process would not allow us to disclose a pending investigation. So as long as we file some type of action against an individual, we can then go in and disclose that, yes, we've taken this action and there are additional investigations going on against a person. Another SB 53 provision is escrow reporting. This one requires brokers who perform five or more escrow transactions in a year or whose escrow activity exceeds $1 million in a calendar year to file a report notifying the Department of the escrow activity within 60 days after the end of the calendar year or be subject to a penalty. Report format is still under development. DRE to receive and post online, and we'll record the information on the licensee's record. This provision becomes effective July 1 of 2012, and the first reports are due within 60 days after the beginning of the calendar year. So for this first year, if you're doing escrow activities, by March 1st of 2013, you need to file the report going back all through 2012. So that would be the start date for this. That'll be the first year that you would need to report your escrow activity. Delaying license renewals enables the Department of Real Estate to hold up license renewals based on final convictions of certain criminal violations that are known or disclosed on an application. That one also becomes effective July 1 of 2012. This one is if we're notified that there is a criminal conviction, we're not going to want to renew an application. And it's pretty straightforward. Investor notification requires real estate licensees engaged in multi-lender loans to provide information to their investors regarding securities law exemptions under which the licensee is operating. Multi-lender is usually the 10 or less. The 10 investor usually triggers that. In the past, those were considered securities, and so now there's certain requirements, or I should say provisions, that enable a broker to do multi-lender loans without it being a security, and it needs to be disclosed to the licensee. 706, this is the next major piece of legislation. We call it cost recovery, but it too has a number of different provisions to it, effective January 1, 2012. As you can see, it impacts many, many sections of the law there. This bill makes numerous changes to California real estate law intended to enhance DRE's enforcement authority and to provide increased protection to consumers. It provides public protection is the highest priority for DRE in exercising its licensing, regulatory, and disciplinary functions. And in fact, DRE has a new mission statement now that coincides. It's to safeguard and promote the public interest in real estate matters through licensure, regulation, education, and enforcement. So that's a DRE new mission statement. Okay, cost recovery. Like I say, that's one of the big features of 706. It allows DRE to request an administrative law judge direct a licensee found to have violated real estate law to pay the costs associated with the investigation and enforcement action. DRE Information Technology section is enhancing activity tracking reports that will enable the department to provide accurate reports of all employees entering time to investigate a case. The next section of 706, the posting of license status and action, requires DRE to post the status of every license issued on its website, including information on accusations, suspensions, and revocations. The posting of documents is currently underway, with information being uploaded into DRE's website as it's scanned. I mean, it's obviously all the actions that we've taken and over the years have to be all scanned, and so that process is underway. Settlements for prior formal actions allows DRE to enter into settlements with licensees without first filing an accusation or statement of issues. Although this is still considered a disciplinary action, it is a way that we can speed the process without having to first file a formal action. Restrict Restricted license monitoring cost authorizes DRE to charge a fee to cover the costs associated with monitoring the restricted license. DRE is currently developing the details, process, extent, and cost to monitor the status of the restricted license. Petition fee, effective May 1, the other day, in fact. SB 706 allows DRE to recover the cost of processing petitions for restricted licensees who request to have their restrictions removed or a revoked license to be reinstated. The fee is $800, must be submitted with the petition application. Suspend a convicted felon allows DRE to automatically suspend the real estate license and or a mortgage loan originator license endorsement of a licensee who has been incarcerated after a felony conviction. Criminal reporting requirement requires licensees to report to DRE when he or she have been indicted and charged with a felony, convicted of a crime, or had a license disciplinary action taken by another licensing entity or authority of this state, and I would probably say other states as well. Failure to report such action would result in cause for disciplinary action. DRE has developed a notification form, RE 238, that can be used for this, but obviously if you're in jail, you can, any piece of paper will do. Recovery account renamed. The recovery account is now the consumer recovery account. That's pretty much it on 706. Like I say, there's a lot of changes that were brought into those two bodies of law, and they're all meant to give us some additional enforcement powers. The next piece of legislation was SB 510. This is the branch manager. We call it branch manager. It actually includes both branch managers and division managers. So if you wanted to assign responsibility over a branch office, you could do that. Or if you wanted to assign responsibility for a division within your department, your department. I've been a state employee too long. Within your company to a person like an escrow division or something like that, you could use this. So an employed in real estate broker or corporate designated broker officer may appoint a licensee as a manager of a branch office or division of the employing broker or employing corporate designated broker office real estate business and delegate to that manager responsibility to oversee and supervise operations and licensed activities. An appointment of a branch or division manager must include a written contract whereby the manager accepts the delegated responsibility. The employing broker or corporate designated broker officer must retain a copy of this contract and also send completed RE 242 branch/division manager appointment form. That's a new form that we've developed to DRE identifying the appointed manager and the branch office or division that the manager is appointed to supervise. The RE 242 will be available no later than June 30, 2012. As you see, this goes into effect July 1 of 2012. A licensee will be precluded from being appointed if the licensee holds a restricted license, has been subject to an order of disbarment, or is a salesperson with less than 2 years full-time real estate experience within 5 years preceding the appointment. The law also specifies that whenever an appointment of a branch or division manager is terminated or changed, the employing broker or corporate designated broker officer must immediately notify DRE. DRE has developed the 242, as we mentioned. But if you're just changing the branch office, you use the standard RE 203. There's no change to that. And then there's a little citation. Finally, there is the delinquent taxpayers legislation here. It says that it suspends the license of delinquent taxpayers, and that's a list of the top 500 statewide who owe over $100,000 in delinquent taxes. And what we've basically done is we're notified by the Franchise Tax Board and State Board of Equalization with this list, and it impacts real estate licensees and other professional occupational license certificates, registrations, or permits held or maintained by a tax debtor who is on the FTB and or Board of Equalization top 500 largest delinquent taxpayers. Effective date on that one is July 1. This is kind of going down into the micro. When I first started doing some of these things, I thought, well, I'm going to either the tech geeks or the bean counters are going to love what I'm doing, and nobody else will care. So I tried to bring it down to just what we've gone through. But just to look at implementation on 1424, I mean, it's requiring the IT, our IT section, to develop a data download process with the Franchise Tax Board and DOE. It matches taxpayer data with existing licensing records and incoming license application. It notifies our licensing section of potential matches of taxpayer delinquencies. And then a licensing section will send notices to licensees informing them of AB 1424 requirements and suspensions. Will place license suspension on each record until DRE is notified by Franchise Tax Board or Board of Equalization that suspensions can be lifted. Maintains history regarding suspension activity and notifies Franchise Tax Board and Board of Equalization and licensee when the suspensions are lifted. So, that's, I'm out of breath. That's it in a nutshell. you don't realize the work that goes in behind all of these. We're trying to stuff this into our current program. I mean, for instance, IT has got we've got our electronic examination sites that are up and running. We're looking at rebuilding our integrated voice response system to add enforcement to our current licensing IVRs, replacing IVRs in the local offices. We just have a ton of other projects that are being worked on, and yet this, which just came down the pipe on last year's legislation, is all new work that we have no choice but to put it into effect according to the dates defined in the law. Did want to bring up a point here that if you're interested in helping develop or review regulations for the department, you should contact Dan Kehoe. He's an attorney for Wayne working in our legal section at that website address. And that will get you a pre-publication draft of new regulations under development for your review and comment. So that does it for me. Thank you for bearing with me for... And one of the very last slides, by the way, this presentation, all of these presentations will be available on our website in PowerPoint format, so you don't really need to copy down too much of this if you don't want to. But anyway, I thank you all, and like Mr. Sandry to take over, please.
All right, thank you, Steve.
And good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for the invitation for us to speak to you again, and welcome to Sacramento, a city we know well. And first off, I want to echo Wayne's thank you for alerting us to some of the bad characters out there. You know, we hear from consumers. It's great to hear from the industry that cares about some of the people out there doing things improperly. So, okay, I want to relate to you a couple of audit stories to demonstrate an issue DRE auditors have been facing of late. These are but examples of four or five recent cases where auditors have encountered the same deceitful behavior. So in the first case, the DRE received complaints from two property owners alleging that the broker who operated a property management business far away from any DRE office sent months... it could happen anywhere, but this is part of the story. Sent monthly proceeds checks to the owners, and these checks were returned NSF. There were possible insufficient funds in the broker trust account, and that's certainly enough to get a DRE auditor out there. So the auditor arranged to meet with the broker for the audit and sent an appointment letter detailing the records to be examined. During the entrance conference on the first day, the broker only talked to the auditor briefly regarding the property management activities and appeared to be very nervous. She could not give firm answers to the auditor's questions on her property management activities. She kept on changing the subject and talking about being a good mother for the two children she had and the beneficent public works that she was doing. Now, I just got to say that auditors can be really chatty people, too, but that's as long as they know that there's cooperation taking place. So eventually the auditor learned that the broker managed 56 properties for 55 property owners and collected about $75,000 in trust funds per month. And trust funds were deposited into two bank accounts. The auditor requested separate records and trust fund reconciliation plus bank statements. And the broker told the auditor that the separate records were in each of the property management files. She could get them out herself. And then after that, the broker walked out of the conference room and back to her desk and started making phone calls. And she never did come back to the conference room. When the auditor again requested reconciliations and bank statements, the broker told her that she'd print them out, but then delayed doing so for the rest of the day in spite of numerous requests. By late in the day, the broker had still only provided limited documents and began insisting that the auditor communicate requests through the broker's assistant. The broker told the auditor she was leaving for the bank to deposit rent and would not be coming back. The broker seemed surprised that the auditor was planning to return to continue the audit on the next day. But we hadn't gotten anything. But they agreed, so they agreed to meet. The next day, the auditor arrived at the business location and found a note on the door which read, "Please call me when you get here. I had to take my son to an appointment. Sorry I did not call. I couldn't find your number. Thank you, the broker." Of course, the auditor called the broker right away, and the phone was not answered. The auditor left a message. Fortunately, over an hour later, the assistant arrived at the locked office and provided two bank statements and a note from the broker which read, "Hope this is all you need. Any questions, please call. Sorry I couldn't meet with you," the broker. Again, the panicked auditor called the broker right away, and the broker did not answer the phone. The auditor left a message explaining all the records needed as detailed in the appointment letter and verbally the day before. Additional delays followed, including the broker's failure to show, unreturned phone calls, the broker's inability to locate additional bank statements, the alleged printer failure, making it difficult to print requested records,
The broker's inability to provide any reconciliations due to a complete lack of access to her daughter's computer, and on. So, interestingly, a quick review of the two bank statements that were provided revealed that the bank statements, the bank balances after each transaction did not add up. So finally, after many attempts and numerous three-hour trips to this distant town, only some of the records had been provided. The DRE auditor returned to her home office, prepared a subpoena ducis tecum, which is a subpoena for records, traveled back to the broker's town, and with difficulty located the broker to, and served a copy of the subpoena to the broker in a nail salon. The original subpoena, which requested bank statements, was then served to the on the broker's bank, and the broker was also served with a subpoena requesting, you know, the records to be provided by her personally. By and by, the bank mailed the original bank statements to the DRE auditor. As suspected, numbers on the bank statements provided by the broker had been greatly altered compared to the original bank statements provided by the bank. And yes, that's a major red flag. To demonstrate the differences between the altered bank statements provided by the broker and those sent to the auditor by the bank, you can see that for the first of the two trust accounts used, the bank account balance on the bank statement provided by the broker shown in the second column was made to be much higher than the actual bank statement balance on the statement provided by the bank, which shows in column two. In column three. The bank's balances in this case were totally altered. The dollar figures are not nearly the same. And by the way, that really takes a lot of work to do. And hence, you know, there's a delay in providing records because you're working on it. Okay. So, unfortunately, in many of these cases, the since it's hard to do, those numbers don't add up often. So, in this way, it was hoped that the auditor would use the altered bank balance and conclude that there was an appropriate amount of money in the trust account. And this was an attempt to hide a missing $100,000 to $110,000 in trust account in the first bank account, as you can see in the column that's on the far right. The bank statements of the second bank account were also used for trust fund handling, had similar $100,000 plus differences due to alterations. So, you know, clearly something was up, right? Stating the obvious. After the receipt of subpoenas, the broker did provide accounting records via her daughter, and the audit revealed a trust fund shortage of $228,569.93 in two bank accounts. The shortage was caused by over-disbursement of management fees in an amount over $224,000. The broker would just show the taking of money as, you know, management fees, and they're way beyond what was earned. And there was also negative owner balances of over $4,000. In a letter, the broker explained that she had suffered personal financial struggles following the loss of her house by fire. So the broker surrendered her real estate license, and the terms of the surrender, if you will, including having to pay for the cost of the audit and all its delays. The broker was also issued a bar order, which prevents her from working in or associating with any related business for a period of 3 years. These cases are often sad in that there may be a tragic event that sets somebody down the wrong path. But what is also sad is that adversity is an opportunity to demonstrate integrity, strength, and perseverance. And alas, that was not done here. So the issue we've been seeing of late is altered bank statements and documentation. And briefly, I have another example of this that took place in a recent case. In this case, the auditor and special investigator sensed a forthcoming delay, and the broker was served with a subpoena for records on the day of the entrance conference. And yet delays followed, with the broker claiming the need for more time to obtain records from the bank. What often happens in cases of wrongdoing is that the person requested to provide records goes into attack mode to try and get the department to back off in obtaining the requested records. And we've seen this MO before, so we don't back down in this type of case. So here, the broker falsely claimed that the auditor was related to a rival business owner and was trying to help that rival take over his company. And no, that was not correct, not true. And then again, it was later claimed that the auditor was making ridiculous, unreasonable requests. The auditor just wanted the broker to provide accounting and bank records within a period of weeks. So records were provided piecemeal, some transaction files here, some bank statements there, and incomplete records later. And so we also served a subpoena on the bank for the bank statements. And what was the result after a period of months of going through this? A comparison of the bank statements provided by the broker with the bank statements from the bank showed that the bank statement balances were all altered. In this case, very simply by, for example, making the actual ending balance of $4,270.07 in column 3 look like $44,270.07 in column 2 by just adding one digit, which is a 4. In this way, the bank statement provided to the auditor by the broker showed $40,000 more in the account. And yes, the audit work in this case revealed a trust fund shortage of $42,000, largely, again, to the taking of trust funds for personal use. Okay, so let's go over some recent audits, some recent issues we've seen in audits. And so first of all, as Wayne just discussed, trust fund shortages were up in 2011. In 2010, we had 97 audits with trust fund shortages in the cumulative amount of about $7.8 million. In 2011, this number was up to 143 audits with shortages, and the shortage total was nearly $12.4 million. There were also bank statement issues, the altered bank statement issue I just discussed. There have been at least three other cases very recently where the auditor was provided with altered bank statements, again, to try and hide trust fund shortages, including one there was where $80,000 of transfers of earnest money funds by a salesperson were removed from the bank statement, and the balances changed also. And these statements are pretty amazing. They really look real. So we have to be on our toes. In this age of access to electronic bank records and of specialized software for editing, it is easier to alter statements and other documents, including deeds of trust, right? Trust deeds. So our auditors have had to increase verification procedures to ensure that records provided show the real story. These procedures may include extra testing of bank statements and records, or obtaining more records directly from the bank. Incidentally, just on Tuesday of this week, one of our auditors who had been trying to schedule a routine audit with a broker for well over a month received a long letter from the broker's spouse on the day before the scheduled audit. In the letter, the spouse claimed the broker was too ill due to heart failure to meet with the auditor and the business would be closed down. Thank you for going away. Essentially. At the same time, our enforcement section received a phone call from a stressed out person saying that in good conscience, he can no longer continue to alter the same broker's bank statement and is filing a complaint with DRE. So, the broker is well enough to goad and pressure this guy into altering his bank statements, but too sick to open the door for an auditor. So The auditor raced out to the broker's office and found him there working and served him with a subpoena for records. We'll see. This case may be interesting. We are making efforts to perform more routine audits of licensees involved in activities that required increased trust fund handling. So we're doing more routine audits of property management businesses, of private money lending and broker escrow activities, the activities with the greatest risk of trust fund losses. For example, in 2011, we did 68 property management audits versus 20 in 2010. In recent years, due to the high number of complaints that have been coming in, 89% of our audits have been investigative audits, making it difficult to go out and complete these routine high-risk audits. To be more proactive and get more of these high-risk audits done, we are finding ways to be more efficient in investigative audit report writing and file preparation processes. In this way, our 30 field auditors can get out and visit more of the 142,000-plus brokers licensed to operate in California. So thank you, and now we bring back a man with many titles, Bill Moran.
Thank you very much, Dan. And so we'll open it up now for questions and answers. If any of you have questions, and maybe just to start, how many of you have questions regarding the new branch office manager designation? Do we have several of you? Maybe to start with, we'll just have Wayne Bill go ahead and kind of give us a rundown of that and hopefully answer several of your questions.
In the legal affairs forum, we got a number of questions about the branch office and manager issue as well. And the one thing that I want to really just underscore and do it a couple times is that it's voluntary. There's no mandate at all that any broker designate someone as a branch office manager for purposes of this law. And we had a very open series of meetings on broker supervision, and Carr was involved with this. And what we had heard was there are a number of designated officers of large corporations and responsible brokers of large brokerages who wanted to actually diffuse some of the responsibilities that they had and that they had only themselves. And so this legislation went through to allow a broker, and the term that we use is sort of the Uber broker, the ultimate responsible broker, to designate at different branch offices or district offices someone who would be responsible for managing that office. And what that does is it in some ways diffuses the responsibility of the Uber broker to the branch office manager. It's the same way that we in Sacramento can't know everything that's going on in our district offices. I have to assume that a designated officer of a large brokerage sitting in Los Angeles doesn't know what's going on in every branch office in that brokerage. And so the notion was that there could be a designation of somebody, and the requirements are they have to be at least a real estate salesperson with 2 years of experience within the preceding 5 years, no restrictions on the license, and that they accept the responsibility of managing that office, and that person will have responsibility for supervision, management, all those things. But it's completely voluntary. If you don't want to do anything, you don't have to do anything. But it's to allow folks to say, I want to have other people who are responsible. And the reason we thought this was good is because it gave more people who have the responsibility for management the obligation to actually perform those responsibilities, those duties, and that they would be subject to discipline. And we're not certain how this is going to work ultimately, but I would think that if I'm the ultimate designated broker and I've designated someone as a manager, I've trained them, I've put into process procedures and systems, and I've said, okay, now you're trained, and somebody were to sue me and the Department of Real Estate said, well, you're responsible, I'd say, I'm ultimately responsible, I understand that, but why don't we talk with the person who had the responsibility at the local level where they are hiring people, they're reviewing contracts, They're doing the actual day-to-day work. So that's why this law went into effect. It was a collaborative effort among the Department of Real Estate, industry professionals, and CAR. And so this went into effect, and we're looking at the regulations right now. It doesn't go into effect till July. Again, it's voluntary. And the one thing I want to say to everybody here, we would like your input in any regulations we have. We're not out to trick anybody. This is not Big Brother saying we're imposing new responsibilities. It was a industry-led, a collaborative discussion where folks who have this, and it's an immense responsibility, I would think, to be the broker of a huge, huge operation and to have all the responsibility lying on their shoulders. This allows them to say, you know what, let's get real. Let's put some responsibility, real legal responsibility, on the people who are supposed to be doing the work at the local level. So that's basically it. I know there are going to be other questions about this. I'd be glad to stay around afterwards. But it goes into effect in July. We're looking at regulations now. We're not certain how it's ultimately going to work. But that was basically the philosophy as to why this went into effect. And again, if you don't want to designate anyone, you don't have to. You don't have to do anything.
I've got a question here concerning that. If you have an office that you designated a manager or someone to supervise that, and you don't have a contract, will that manager still be held responsible? You have to have a contract?
If you don't follow the strict requirements of this law, that person doesn't have the responsibility. And now, obviously, there's a responsibility to the Department of Real Estate for disciplinary action, and then, of course, you've got just general civil liability. And I can only assume, and I'm not a plaintiff's lawyer. I used to be a defense attorney years ago, but my hunch is a plaintiff's lawyer would sue everybody in the chain. They'd say, okay, this guy was supposed to manage and he didn't, or this woman was supposed to manage and they didn't, and you are the ultimate broker, and therefore you have a responsibility. But from the Department of Real Estate's perspective, we have no ability to discipline someone for not supervising other than the designated officer or the ultimate responsible broker. And this law would change that if and only if you wanted to have someone designated as a responsible district office person.
Can I add something to it? That we have a form, too, that you must fill out to have this person designated, that RE-242. So that form clearly states that you have to have a contract in place, and it also tells the person being appointed as a branch or division manager that they are accepting liability, which could impact their license.
That's right. And that form will be available towards the end of June or early July, because we really don't want to start receiving the forms before the law goes into effect. So that will be available, and you can keep your eye on our website. Yes,
good afternoon, Lupi Soto, Region 30. Are you going to have something in writing that brokers are going to be able to follow? Because I can tell you that I obviously had a really big smile to get clarification from Wayne that this is strictly voluntary. That's not really, I firmly believe that there's so much misunderstanding at this time as to how this is supposed to work. Who's going to be responsible, how it's going to be. There's just so much ambiguity. And, you know, certainly to hear that it's strictly voluntary, I think will really clarify a lot of things. Because, I mean, when you have, let's say, for example, a husband and wife operation, or maybe two people or three people, you know, this was to be mandatory, you know, how is that all going to work out? I totally understand the need when it comes to the large, you know, brokerages, you know, where one broker is responsible for 10,000 agents, you know, across, you know, several counties. But, you know, in other situations, certainly the responsibility level, you know, based on what I've heard of, you know, with regards to the new law, is certainly pretty encompassing for a manager.
Well, one of the things that we might want to do, Bill and Steve and Dan, is put out some sort of an alert in our an article in our bulletin. Now, there are very few of us who are writing right now, and I'll tell you, it's basically a labor of love, and we write over the weekend. So I think though that would help everyone to really kind of understand what the requirements are if someone elects to do this, and the fact that there is no mandate whatsoever. It was simply another option for brokers to think about if they have a large operation with a number of branch offices or district offices.
You know, I'm really puzzled that, you know, it was so clear cut the way you presented it to us right now, and how, you know, we've gone through all these days and for months now, you know, wondering how this is all going to fall into place, because we thought it was a mandatory regulation.
And it's not up here now, but I almost thought we should have highlighted the word may, because it says may designate, okay. And that's the key. You don't have to do anything.
Thank you.
Yeah, the key is, you know, you can delegate responsibilities if the broker can, if the broker chooses. The responsibilities delegated need to be within the four corners of a contract between the broker and the manager. Anything not delegated, the broker has the responsibility to supervise. So it's really the broker has to make a decision as to how effectively can they supervise their entire operation, and if they need managers to handle a lot of the minutiae, they have the ability to make the delegation. If the broker wants to handle all of the minutiae for all the different divisions in a brokerage, that would be the broker's option. Yes.
Bill, my name is Tom Berge from Alhambra. And in California, a college graduate can, for 2 years in real estate, with a degree in real estate, can become a broker and own and manage an office, but yet he can't be a manager of a branch office. Is that correct?
That would be correct. If the broker is a broker, okay, actually any broker can be a manager. A salesperson needs to have 2 years full-time experience. But you're right. So if a broker came in with a college degree, they would qualify to be a manager even though they don't have 2 years full-time experience.
Bill Plattis, Region 32. I'm a broker of 2,000 agents, and I was on the task force that came up with this, and I was thrilled. I'm not quite as thrilled right now because I would rather not to have an option so that other people can share what I do in the middle of the night sometimes. It's really scary when I even had a recently where a board, I belong to like 20 of them, said, we're going to make you go to two sessions doing this for 30 years and learn so you can't advertise a property, because one of your agents went out and advertised a Craigslist listing online, and even though they said they got the approval from the other agent said they didn't give it to them, so that they're holding me responsible for supervision. The whole thing is sort of insane, and I thought this was going to help us have other people who are running the office take some responsibility. So when we come up with this thing, and actually the DRE is really much for it, they see a big problem when you've got 15, 20, or 30 offices, or 100 offices, expecting somebody to know what the heck is going on in some office, you know, 100 miles away, and there's 100 people in there, you know, running back and forth, and what person is in there. When something happens and the DRE audits you, that manager is off the hook, zero responsibility, good luck, nothing. And this is where it started. So I understand if somebody doesn't want a responsibility, they're happy it's an option. But, you know, we're going to have to work through this thing, because we've got to have a system that works, and with multi-office and everything, the system doesn't work as well. So, but I thank you for the start, but we're going to have, it's my opinion, we're going to have to talk about this a little more from a broker's point of view. Otherwise, a responsibility is impossible almost.
Exactly. And to follow up on that, just to be clear, a broker needs to have policies, systems, and procedures in place to adequately supervise their brokerage. If they choose to use others in that process, they can delegate now via the written contract and delegate some of the responsibility. But regardless, the broker has to develop policies and systems and procedures and has to follow up to make sure that those policies and those systems and procedures are being properly carried out in order to have adequate supervision. And that's the way the law has been for a long time. So this adds another layer of option as to how a broker can go about doing that. And actually, in the case you just heard with 2,000 agents, it really is hard to understand how one single broker is going to be able to supervise everything that 2,000 agents is doing, but if they want to take a crack at it, they can. It's just they're going to be responsible for supervising. Yes.
Cindy Dahl, Region 31. I have two questions. The first one being CAR just created a standard form to use for brokers and managers to sign. If they sign the CAR form, are they still, in addition, going to have to fill out your RE-242 and send it to you?
Yes. We don't actually get the contracts. All we get is the notification. So we want to know that, you know, the contracts between you and the manager. Okay, you have to notify us, and that's going to go on the public license information that there is a manager over a branch or over a division.
Okay. Second question is, when all these hundreds and hundreds of RE-242 forms start getting mailed to you, would it not be a lot easier if on your e-licensing site, every broker can fill out those hundreds and hundreds of pieces of info through e-licensing and avoid you shuffling papers?
Yeah, that is one of the additions that we're...
It will be implemented electronically?
Yes, we're the branch office. Right now, Sandra, correct me if I'm wrong, branch office applications are not on e-licensing, nor is this new form yet. But my IT section is working on getting both of those incorporated into the e-licensing system. And right now, for those forms that we have on e-licensing, we're about 70% of everything we receive come in through the licensing process. So that is something definitely that's on the agenda.
Thank you. Yes.
Good afternoon. Tracy Faison, Region 3. And Cindy and I are on the same committee, Standard Forms. This was heavily debated in our four-hour meeting today. And we were even wordsmithing the may and maybe add in may not. We didn't really think that this was optional. And actually, in lots of conversation that we had about it, we were thinking it would be really great if it was mandatory, because there are a lot of brokers who are hiring somebody that doesn't have the 2 years real estate license experience, somebody that's working part-time in real estate and then getting commissions for that on the side, and then getting paid a salary to review files when they don't have the experience to do so. And I think that the standard of professionalism in many of these large offices is far below standard. And I just think that this form may need to be rethought to where it actually becomes something that is used standardly.
Okay, and yes, that move would actually require new legislation. The way the legislation went through, it does use the word may. And so, you know, it's better than what we had before, in my opinion. And it does give the broker an option, and it basically also leaves the broker with no excuse if they don't exercise that option and if their supervisory scheme is found to be inadequate. But, yeah, at this point, per the legislation and per the law, the word may is there, and it would take new legislation to change that. Yes.
Gordon Maddock. Cite and fine. Help me understand that. In other words, like, if you see a minor infraction on an audit or something like that, you have the ability to cite us and ask for a fine as opposed to prosecuting us all the way through?
That's correct. So, in essence, Wayne, do you want to take that?
Yeah. I want to respond to the question about cite and fine. This also was another collaboration, and so you know there are a number of departments in the state that have citation authority and fine authority. The idea came up in our world because there are people who are operating in an unlicensed capacity, and then there are licensees who have committed minor violations. And the way it worked and works now before the citation and fine regulations go into effect, is our investigators would go out, they'd find a minor violation, they would go back to the office, they'd write up a long report, it would then go to the legal section, and we'd issue a desist and refrain order and say, bring yourself into compliance. So the idea was to come up with a very quick, pretty simple way to tackle technical violations and bad business practices where a citation can be issued, those things can be corrected. A fine may accompany the citation, may not. And we had discussions, long discussions with Carr about whether the citations and fines would be deemed to be formal discipline. The answer is they're not deemed to be formal discipline. They will not be on the public record. The only way those things will get out into the public is if someone were to ask for our records and send in a Public Records Act request and say we'd like to know all citations that were issued against Broker A or all fines paid by Broker B or whatever. But they will not be considered to be formal discipline. We're working on our regulations right now. We have a draft, and that's going to be up on the website, too. So if you took down Dan Keyhew's name and that regulation site, if you could look at those, we'd be glad for you to look at those. But the idea, because we're just kind of taking itty-bitty steps going forward, is we would have a task force at the department. And we will have a central desk so that one investigator can't be more enthusiastic than another and say, okay, we're going to issue 10 citations, $2,500 each. It will be handled out of a central district, and then we will see how this works out as it proceeds. But the idea is we'd have an investigator go out, see what's wrong, come back to the office, write up a report, and we'll come to the central desk, and then we'll basically have like buckets, and we'll say, okay, this is definitely a citation. This should not be discipline. This may be a DNR. This may be something more formal. And so we're just kind of looking at it right now, and we've talked with the Bureau of Automotive Repair. We've talked to I've talked to people at ABC, and then we've also talked to people at the Contractors License Board. And we're trying to get the benefit of their history, what they've done. But the idea is it's going to give us some immediate ways to correct bad minor violations, and it won't be public discipline for the brokers who are engaged in those acts.
Okay, so my friend who has owned a major property management company for years, who had $1,000 accidentally put in one account and in another account,
yes,
had to go full discipline,
yes,
and all that stuff on his. So maybe something like that might just be
exactly
a sight and fun.
That's right. Exactly. That's exactly right.
And the benefit to the broker, to the industry, or the salesperson is, you don't have an H number that follows you around for the rest of your career, because a lot of times public looks up a license record, they see an H number. That H number doesn't necessarily say what happened, and you know it might be for something very minor. So it's really a fairness thing, and we're trying to use it in a way that doesn't blemish someone's career, but it's just a minor thing.
And the questions you have are the same questions we have at the department. For instance, if someone says, well, I didn't do anything wrong, We're thinking of actually having some very easy ways for someone can send us a letter, and then we'll respond within a certain period of time. If the letter doesn't solve anything, then they can have an informal hearing at the department. And then we're also going to have a way that people can have a formal hearing. And so that it doesn't become discipline on the formal hearing, we might have a C number. And that way someone can challenge our citation, and if they win, great. If they don't, it's still just a citation. And that's all there is.
Very good. Yes.
You have
we'll take the question from the people standing, and I think we're in a little bit over.
You have to excuse my voice. I think I have the Sacramento flu or cold or something. My name is Don Riedinger, Region 32. I received a message on my cell phone this morning from a young lady, and I'm fairly confident that she didn't realize I was going to be at the DRE forum today. She left the message. She said that she was a relocation specialist, not licensed, and she wanted to make arrangements for her to show one of my listings. I called her back and asked her, you know, restate what she wanted, and she said that she works with high-end relocating executives, and she chooses areas to show them around, and then narrows it down and then shows properties that are for lease or for rent to these folks. And I said, you're not sure that you're supposed to be a licensed real estate agent? She said, well, no, I'm not an agent. I'm a relocation specialist.
If you could turn her name into us.
And then I'll finish this quick little story. Is I'll be glad to do that, because she said, well, if you're not going to cooperate with me, I have 6 other properties that I'm going to be showing them in the next couple of days. So
okay.
I'll be glad to give you the name and her phone number.
Very good. Thank you. Yes.
My apologies. This is Joe McGowan. I am with Region 14. And a quick clarification back on the broker-manager situation. Because I think the confusion is maybe over scenario whereby a broker does designate managers for their offices, if they have in fact designated a manager, must they use this process?
I'll answer that. To me, the way I would separate it in my head is I would say there is the statutory designation, which shifts some responsibility, responsibility onto a district or division person, and it puts them in the line of discipline if they don't do what they're supposed to do. And then you have everything else, the non-statutory designations, which you can do all day, every day now. You can say, okay, you're going to be the assistant here, you're going to be the manager here, and there's no statutory obligations imposed on them. It's only if you want to make use of this statutory provision where there's a delegation of authority to a branch office manager that we care.
Okay, thereby, so if part of their supervision process and procedures includes relegating those responsibilities to an individual, then this applies.
Right.
Yes, but you can do this. You can do this all day right now. I know there are brokers out in this audience who have responsible people managing offices, and they've done the training, and they have the systems in place, and they've said, okay, you manage, you have to review the contracts, and if they look like they're significant, send them to us. So they're doing all of this right now. The only thing this law does is it gives a broker the ability to say, you know what, we have used this legislative mechanism to diffuse some of our responsibility because we have elected this person. They now have a legal responsibility to manage more closely, to do what they're supposed to do, and if there's discipline, the department can impose the discipline on that manager, whereas right now we can't if we don't use this statute.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. SB 53, this is for Steve Ellis. Is this for designated brokers or broker associates for having to report the escrow reporting?
Escrow reporting portion is for the broker of record, the broker of the company, whoever that is, or the corporate broker officer of the corporation.
Whichever license is being used to run the escrow activities.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
If you're working under the license. But see, obviously, the real estate license doesn't show what broker you're working for. It said that you're a broker working on your own.
Yeah.
Right. And but it's under the broker of record for that office.
Right, it'd be the broker of record for that office.
And you've got to remember, too, under this branch office, it's actually a – you can delegate to run a division of your company as well as a branch office. So it's not just limited to branch office. It's also you could delegate that broker associate to be the head of your escrow division. Now, I still think the ultimate responsibility to report the escrow would fall on the Google broker. We call him the major broker.
That's right. Okay, yes.
Hi, two questions. You can only have $200 of your personal money in a trust account, and I believe it's been that way for a long time. And there was some discussion in another forum earlier. Is there any discussion about raising that $200 limit?
That's a damn question.
Yeah.
No, we are not. There's no current discussion going on raising that limit. That'll cover, most. We have recently surveyed banks and found that the $200 is generally sufficient. The danger with raising it is that it does expose the trust funds in the account to seizure by other agencies, by IRS, et cetera, who don't really care about that volume. They're going to look and see, are their broker funds going in and out of the account or remaining in the account? So, our survey showed that generally the $200 has been sufficient to cover bank charges, et cetera.
Well, the context was a lot of the banks, if you don't maintain at least $1,000, they get dinged a fee. And so it may cost the client money. And then also, with some of the owners, if they're running, if they got one tenant saying they bounce a check, you may very quickly be having insufficient funds to cover if the check is, if another check has been sent out before it's cleared.
Right, and that, and you know, we've always said our, the best practice is to, you know, make sure the money that you deposit clears first, or you know, on first demonstration that you've got somebody depositing money who's not reliable, you impose stricter standards on them as far as you hold the money in there, either hold a reserve in there or require that their funds that comes in stays there for a certain period of time before you pay out. You can also, again, have reserves held belonging to your clients just to cover that situation. You don't want to cover those with broker money sitting in the trust account. It just puts everything at risk.
And let's try to, just the people standing up, if anyone else has any questions, you can come up and talk to us afterwards, but we, you know, probably should be wrapping this up. I don't know if there's another group coming in here.
Just one other, oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Just one follow-up question. It wasn't a follow-up, but if someone doesn't pay the citation fines that you were talking about, what's the mechanism for enforcement on that?
If they're licensed, we could suspend the license for failure to pay the fine amount. Many of the licensees we've talked to actually have said we would love to have a citation and a fine rather than a formal discipline. And so it's suspension, and with unlicensed people, obviously, we'd have to look at collection agencies or something like that, because we assume that most of the unlicensed people are going to just not do anything.
And we wouldn't renew a license either with outstanding debts. Yes.
Yes, I would like to request if you would have communication with our leadership and our legal department with a clarification that you gave to us today. Because, again, like it was said earlier today from Standard Forms, I was highly debated as to how this was going to fall into place and in our legal forum as well. And we have to take it back to our grassroots when we go back home tomorrow and be able to, you know, give a very clear-cut explanation the way you did to us today. So we appreciate
you
that.
You're talking about site and fine, or are you talking about the branch office manager issue?
I'm sorry, the branch manager issue.
Now, we did discuss it today at the Legal Affairs Forum, and so Jenny Lee is familiar with it, and one of the other lawyers for Carr is familiar with the answer.
Okay.
The primary answer is it's voluntary, totally voluntary. And we will put something together for a bulletin, and okay. I just don't know when that will take place, but we will.
Thank you.
Be out with the next bulletin. I think we just published one, so we'll be with the next publication. Yes.
Rita Tayanaka, Region 32. If I'm a broker and I have an agent doing property management underneath me, somebody just told me that I need to hire them as an employee versus an independent contractor. Is that under your auspice?
No, all real estate salespersons, as far as the real estate law is concerned, are considered employees. The independent contractor, for tax purposes, that's really outside of what we would review. But, you know, we don't make that distinction.
Okay.
Lisa Dunn, Region 32. Question regarding branch managers. If one is designated by a broker to be managing a branch office, do they have to hold a California real estate license?
Yes.
Thank you.
Bill Jansen. Hi, Bill. How are you?
Hi.
Wayne, I have a question for you. You were at the Legal Affairs Forum, as was I. I just came from Legal Affairs Forum, where confusion reigns over what you said or what some people thought you said. So I'm here to ask the question. And it involves the branch manager, the new law regarding registering with branch managers. So some people are reading 101.6.4. Paragraph A says it's discretionary.
Yes.
You may do this.
Yes.
Then paragraph C says the branch manager shall only be appointed by written contract, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So is it your interpretation then that if I delegate to a branch manager, that is still totally discretionary to register with you, or does paragraph C require the registration with you if I appoint someone who does those three? And there's a sub-question here. There's three triggers, right? Day-to-day operations, supervision, and I've forgotten what the third one is under paragraph A. And they all seem to read together because they're conjunctive.
Lawyers are so fun. I like how Bill says I have three subparts.
Right. Yeah. So there's the trigger question, and then the question is, do you have to, or is it still discretionary totally?
Now, we all would love legislation to be nice and clear, but it never is, and that's why we do regulations, because we have to clarify or implement them. My own interpretation right now, and I'd ask my colleagues here if they disagree, my own interpretation is, if and only if you elect to designate someone under that statutory provision, and again, it's entirely mandatory, then it has to be in writing. Then C applies.
Right.
But right now, and going forward, if someone runs a brokerage, a designated officer, and they say, you know what, I don't want to do all this stuff under the statute. I want to call my friend that I grew up with, or I want to have the person who works with me and has worked with me for years, they're going to run my office in Carlsbad, and my other friend's going to run my office in San Diego. They don't have to do all this stuff. They can do what they've done for years and years and years. They don't have to follow that. This is all, at least that's my interpretation.
I agree. Here's the thing. If the broker does not designate in writing those responsibilities
under that statute
and place those responsibilities on an individual, the broker is responsible. So if something goes awry in a branch office or in a division, and it's, what was your supervisory scheme? Well, my supervisory scheme was that I'm responsible for everything, and the broker's responsible for everything.
Can I just pick two words out of there? You said in writing. What if I'm running a branch office, and I've got a branch manager out there who for years and currently is running the office? They're placing the ads, they're hiring people, they're training, and they're reviewing all the files and doing the broker supervision stuff under 2725, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, July 1 comes.
Yes.
They are still, I haven't given them in writing, but I'm the broker.
Yes.
I'm never going to set foot in that office. I'm never going to look at one of those files.
Right.
I have that person doing it for me. So I have delegated to them, but not in writing.
Right.
So 1164 doesn't apply to me then, right?
I don't think it applies to you at all. It's
really?
Only if you want it to apply to you. And the people who want it to apply to them have the ability to say, you know, I have for too many sleepless nights worried about all the thousands of people I have or the hundreds of people. I want to be able to put some legal responsibility on my branch office managers, and therefore I'm electing to designate somebody, and I'm going to do it in writing, and I'm going to notify the Department of Real Estate, and therefore they have responsibility too, and I can sleep a little better at night because I still have responsibility, but they now have a legal obligation as well. But you don't have to, at least my interpretation, you don't have to do anything today, tomorrow, July 1 or after July 1 unless you want to.
Yeah,
and so for audit purposes, we're in the same position as we were before. If I have implemented practice procedures and rules and supervisory of those practice procedures and rules as before, and I haven't designated that person with you in writing, I'm still, your auditor is going to say things are okay because I've got that person there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Great. And you give guidance on that in writing before July 1? Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.